Well, let's turn to Exodus chapter 1. Remember the Jesus style this coming weekend, Friday night and Saturday? If any of you sit here tonight and you are in some kind of a crazed state of mind that you're not planning on going, you're saying, nothing could be that good, I don't believe it, it's not worth making arrangements for. I hope you'll reconsider. I hope you seek the Lord on it. The problem will be is that Gail will come into town, he will do what he does, and he will leave. And those who don't come under what God speaks through his life will never really have a sense that they missed anything, but at the same time, they won't understand what they did miss. And that'd be sad for me as a pastor, especially since we've done such great work to bring it into the community, and I certainly want all of you to be impacted by God's gift in this man's life and the message that God has given to him. The book of Exodus is, the very title means going out. I was asked tonight by a very brilliant woman, vivacious, attractive, a knockout. What's your name? Karen Kyle? You're married to me? You're mine? She asked me if we were going into Exodus. Which is kind of a funny way to put it, I thought so anyway, but it's the kind of humor that keeps our household going. We're going into going out. The theme of Exodus is restoration or deliverance. And really, Exodus is a continuation of the account that God gives in the book of Genesis. And God has taken the children of Israel, this family, the descendants of Jacob, renamed Israel, into Egypt. And it is there that in the womb of this nation called Egypt that he is changing them into what he has intended all along for them to be and to become, and that is to move from being a family to becoming a nation, which he had promised would happen. And so by the time we come here to Exodus, they have been in Egypt about 300 years. And God is now getting them ready to bring them out of Egypt. And he begins in verse 1 by saying, now these are the names of the children of Israel who came to Egypt. Each man and his household came with Jacob: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. And all those who were descendants of Jacob were 70 persons, for Joseph was in Egypt already. And Joseph died, all his brothers and all that generation. But the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied, grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. And so God, true to his word and faithful in his working in this family, they become a nation. And we're going to see as they come out of the nation of Egypt, that they're going to have gone from being a family of 70 people to probably a nation of between 2 and 3 million men, women, and children. And so they're multiplying, and then they're growing exceedingly mighty, and there's just this explosion that's going on among God's people, even in this very, very, what was becoming an increasingly difficult situation. And this provokes a response on the part of the world. And we see the response here in verse 8. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Not only did he not know Joseph, he probably didn't even know of Joseph. Here it's Joseph so faithful in being used by God to preserve even Egypt through this time of tremendous drought that they had been in, the 70 years of famine that had come upon the land. But A few generations go by and they don't even remember who their former deliverers were or who the God was that worked through that person. And we live in this, what have you done for me now lately world. And because of that, we get forgotten pretty quickly. And God's people get forgotten pretty quickly. God's leaders get forgotten pretty quickly. And so they don't even think of Joseph anymore. And he said to his people, look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. And that's always a threat to the world. The world is threatened here. Egypt is threatened by the fact that God's people are multiplying. And the world is always threatened when God's people multiply, whether it's physically in this sense or it's spiritually in the sense of the age in which we live. When more and more people become God's people and give their life unto Him, it's a threat to them. And it's always going to provoke persecution on the parts of those who hold the reins of power and the world that we live in today. And it's important for us to realize as Christians, when the persecution comes against us, as it comes from Egypt against these people, that it's not a bad sign. It's a good sign that these people are flipped out by what it is that God is doing there. And so they're fearful. And an awful lot of persecution comes against us. Got them. Because they are fearful of us. And I won't get into it. And so he says, look, they're getting more, they're getting mightier. Come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply and it happen in the event of war that they also join our enemies and fight against us and so go up out of the land. And so he says, these guys could turn on us in a battle and we'd be in a lot of trouble. Now, it's a dangerous thing when a government makes its chief concern the preservation of its own power rather than existing to serve its constituency or its people. Because ultimately it leads to bad decisions and ultimately it leads to the oppression of the common person by the powers that be. And these godly people would have made wonderful neighbors. There was no reason to attempt to wipe them out or to kill them. There's no reason for the world to try and wipe out and destroy Christians. They make wonderful neighbors. They make wonderful citizens. They can get as goony as the rest of the people at times, but they're largely harmless. They're the salt of the earth, actually, and the light of the world. And so because of their power struggle and what they're wanting to do and their agenda, they see God's people as in the way. And so they're going to go against God's people, but they don't understand that God's people are not just people, but they're God's people. And there's a God that is in relationship with these people, and thus to go against them is to enter into alignment against their God. Now, in the secular realm, in the realm that doesn't take God into account, they have no consideration as it relates to God or any of that. That's nonsense to them. But it doesn't make God any less of a reality as it relates to our lives, and it doesn't make their attempts to destroy the people of God any less futile. And so they're going to try and deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it happened in the event of war, that they also join our enemies and fight against us and go up out of the land. We don't want to lose this slave labor that we have. And therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramses, but the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were in dread of the children of Israel. And so the more persecution that went against God's people, it just created more of God's people. And so the Bible teaches that we're to be very, very concerned when all men speak well of us. I don't regret the day that we live in today in terms of the hostility that is against Christians and all of the misrepresentation and the fighting that comes out against us and all of the you know, pseudo-intellectual language to hide what the hearts and the attitudes of people are towards God's people. I look at it and I say, all right, everything's out in the light. Now we know what we're working with. Now we know, you know, what's going on. Everything's out in the open here. And so it's an interesting time. It's a dark time. It's a difficult time, these days that we live in. But at least things are a little more honest and open than they have been in the past on the part of the enemies as it relates to God's people. Persecution is very, very healthy for the church, and it's very, very healthy for individuals. And so the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor. And that means literally to break them in pieces. They started to work them very, very hard as a slave force. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage and mortar and brick and all manner of service in the field. All their service with which they made them serve was with rigor. And then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was this and the name of the other was that. And he said, when you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stools, doesn't that sound comfortable? If it is a son, then you shall kill him, but if it's a daughter, then he shall live. And this has been a frequent solution on the part of evil men all through man's history as it relates to dealing with the Jews. Let's kill them. Let's wipe them out. And this is the attempt on Pharaoh's part. Wipe out the men. They're the ones that can fight against us. But if it's a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. We ought to always obey God rather than men. And so the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive? And the midwives said, Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them. It just happens fast there. And therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very mighty. And so it was because the midwives feared God that he provided households for them. How did God bless the midwives for their faithfulness to him? By giving them children. He actually considers them a blessing. And they are. And we have to be very, very careful in our thinking and for the trials that we go sometimes through with our children and the phases that we go through. And sometimes, you know, we can listen to one person's nightmare as it relates to a situation with their child, and we don't see what's completely happened there, and we don't see the final end of what's going to happen there. And all kinds of fear can grip our hearts forever and always as it relates to our kids, and we can end up raising them up into adulthood and the whole time just afraid of what they're going to ultimately do and miss 18 years of enjoying them and the gift that they are. There are trials and there are difficulties. The Lord takes them through them, but let's be careful as it relates to our attitude towards children today just because they've become disposable in the world. That's not God's attitude toward them. And so it was, because the midwives feared God, that he provided households for them, and so Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born you shall cast into the river the Nile, and every daughter you shall save alive. And you look at this whole situation of chapter 1, and you know, life's been going halfway decent for them there in Egypt. And all of a sudden, the furnace gets turned up. All of a sudden, things begin to get very difficult for the children of Israel. And there's a reason for it. Because God has got to place within their heart a dissatisfaction concerning their condition and concerning their place in Egypt, so that they will be ready for the deliverer that he is going to send to deliver them from Egypt. And if it weren't for him making things a little hot, a little uncomfortable, Moses would come on the scene and say, let's get out of here. And everybody would go, are you kidding me? My CDs are just about to mature. I'm not getting out of here. And so here he is, he's preparing them for the deliver. He's preparing them for being motivated to get out of there when he calls them to get out of there. And oftentimes he does that in our lives too. Things begin to get uncomfortable. Boy, we thought we had covered everything as it relates to our retirement, or as it relates to our security, as it relates to this thing. And all of a sudden, you know, everything's being messed up, and they're throwing everything into the Nile on me, and they're making it harder and harder and crushing and crushing. And what's going on here, Lord? What's happening? And very, very often, it's a very good thing that's happening. He wants me extra sensitive to Him for what it is that He's doing and what it is that He's going to do so that I won't miss it when He does it. So He's preparing them for a deliverer. Now we get into chapter 2, and we read how He prepares the deliverer. And a man of the house of Levi went and took a wife of a daughter of Levi. And we'll find out a little later his name is Amram and her name is Jochebed. And so the woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him 3 months. That's interesting. What a lousy time to get married and have kids. You ever think that, those of you who are still interested in having kids? He's looking, oh, I'm going to get married and have kids. Who knows what the economy's going to do? Who knows what those dumb Egyptians are going to do in terms of things out there? And yet here they are, just as a part of God's plan for their life, and it is God's plan because they're going to give birth to the deliverer. They go ahead and they get married. They go ahead and have children. God's going to take care of them. It's going to require faith, but God's going to take care of them. And so they hide the child for 3 months. That must have been a challenge. Those are very difficult 3 months to hide a child when they're looking for all of the sons to kill them. And when she could no longer hide him, she took an ark of bulrushes for him, daubed it with asphalt and pitch, and put the child in it and laid it in the reeds by the river's bank. And Hebrew says that was a step of faith. Yes. Yeah, there are crocodiles in that river. And so she takes her child and puts the child there. And his sister, Miriam, she's probably about 14 or 15 at this point, she stood afar off to know what would be done to him. And so there they are, walking by faith, but they want to see what God's going to do here. So they put the child in there. Aaron's probably about 3 years old, a little older than Moses, so he hasn't come under this edict. He survives. They're going to find out what happens to this boy. And then the daughter of Pharaoh came down. Oh, just happened to. Oh, no, there's no just happened to's. To wash herself at the river. And her maidens walked along the river's side. And when she saw the ark among the reeds, she sent her maid to get the ark. And when she had opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby wept. And she had compassion on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." And then his sister Miriam comes up and says to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse for you from among the Hebrew children?" There would be plenty who would be ready to nurse, given the loss of their child, "that she may nurse the child for you." And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." And so the maiden went and called the child's mother. And then Pharaoh's daughter said to Jochebed, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I'll give you wages." And so the woman took the child and nursed him. Now you talk about doing exceeding abundantly above all you could ask or think. She gets the child given back to her. She gets to nurse her own child, continue to raise that child, and she gets paid to do it. And isn't God good? That's a great deal. I gave you a little pocket money while we're doing this. It's wonderful. And you can imagine as she takes that Moses, he's going to be named in a moment, into her arms. You can imagine how she raised him.
Yahweh is God, Yahweh is God, Yahweh is God, Yahweh is God, Yahweh is God. Pyramids are nothing, Sphinx are nothing, sorcery is demonic, God is everything, Yahweh, and just speaking of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the history of this great people in those formative years. Someone has said, you give me a child until they're 7 years old and you can have them the rest of their life. There may be something to that. And she got to have them for quite a while. It's quite a while before they weaned children in those days. Beautiful. And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And so she called his name Moses, saying, because I drew him out of the water. The name Moses means drawn out. How prophetic. God says, you go ahead and name him Moses. And I won't even bother to change his name. It fits him. But you have no idea how it fits him and who he's going to draw out of this nation that he's been born into. And it's interesting to note, too, concerning the parents of Moses, that they raised their child, and they raised their child based upon faith. They raised that child the best that they know how to raise that child until that child is taken out of their hands. And for 80 years, they're going to see very little fruit in terms of what a parent would want to see out of their son. He is going to look like an absolute loser for 80 years. Looks like he's going to be a nothing. Looks like nothing is going to happen. Looks like our trust in God concerning that child and God getting something good out of him, and it looks like he's been hopelessly brainwashed by the Egyptians. God will never be able to undo what it is that they've had 40 years to pound into his mind. Wanna bet? Wanna bet? It's a great encouragement to us as parents to be patient. Be patient because of the God we serve. Now it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown, and so a 40-year period, the first 40 years of Moses' life occurs right there between verses 10 and 11. And so here he is coming through that first 40 years. And the Bible tells us concerning that first 40 years that he was trained up in a powerful way as it relates to the things of Egypt. In fact, Moses' life, he lived 120 years, and his life breaks into three 40-year periods, 120 years, three 40-year periods, and the first 40-year period was he was raised in Egypt. And here he is in this land of Egypt, getting all of their education, all of the great things that he was learning there, and as he was becoming learned, as Stephen preached in Acts chapter 7, in all of the wisdom of the Egyptians, mighty in word and deed, he spends the first 40 years of his life becoming something. And then he spends the next 40 years of his life on the backside of a desert, becoming nothing. And then he spends the last 40 years of his life learning how God is able to bring something out of nothing. And that's the way that he works in all of our lives. So this first 40 years, here he is. He's becoming learned in all of the wisdom of the Egyptians, mighty in word and deed. This guy was a great pupil. He learned everything that had been put forward to him. And it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out to his brethren and he looked at their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. And he looked this way, and he looked that way. And when he saw no one, failed to look up, it was just commonly spoken concerning this verse, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And so he saw the need for God's people to be delivered from the oppression of Egypt, and so he takes it into his hands. And he's the right man, he's in the right place, But the timing's wrong, and it ends up in a disaster. And so he went out on the next day, and behold, two Hebrew men were fighting with one another. And he said to the one who did the wrong, "Why are you striking your companion?" And then the man said to him, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" And so Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known. They're going to kill me for this." And the Bible tells us in the New Testament that Moses was baffled because he thought that they would understand. He thought God's people would understand that he was come to deliver them and that they would have followed him. And here he takes his first step in what he believed was God's will for his life, and his leadership is utterly rejected by the people, completely and totally rejected. And so when Pharaoh heard of this matter, he sought to kill Moses. And right there, Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well, and so begins the second 40-year period of his life. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water, and they filled the troughs to water their father's flock. And then the shepherds came and drove them away, so that these shepherds, these guys, would wait till they filled up the trough. As soon as they got them filled, you know, okay, looks like they got them filled, then they'd bring their herds in and lap up all the water and make them do it all over again. Nice guys. And then the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. And when they came to Reuel, their father, he said, "How is it that you have come so soon today?" And they said, "An Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds, and he also drew enough water for us and watered the flock." And so he said to his daughters, "And where is he? Why is it that you have left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." And then Moses was content to live with the man, and he gave Zipporah, his daughter, to Moses, and she bore him a son and called his name Gershom, which means stranger there, for he said, "I have been a stranger in a foreign land." And it happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died. And then the children of Israel groaned because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry came up to God because of the bondage. And so God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God acknowledged them. So God hadn't forgotten about them. He hadn't forgotten about his plan for them. And so Moses, it tells us in verse 1 of chapter 3, he kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And so this is the encapsulation of an entire 40-year period of this man's life. He turns into a sheep herder. Now, you remember when we were looking in Genesis, the Egyptians thought that shepherds were an abomination. That was the worst job you could have, just a stinky, lousy, rotten job. Now, in that day, the shepherds were men of, they didn't have a very good reputation. They were not only looked at in terms of what they did as a low kind of unskilled thing, but when they came into town, they were typically thieves. And so nobody thought too highly of a shepherd. And so here is Moses. He goes, as Stephen speaks in the book of Acts, here goes the guy who is really, rather as Josephus says concerning Moses, that he's second only unto Pharaoh. Really, he's in line to become Pharaoh himself in Egypt, and he goes from that to becoming a sheep herder in the Sinai Peninsula, in the desert. And in those days, there was only one thing worse than being a shepherd. That was being a shepherd in a desert. There's only one thing worse than that, and that was being a shepherd in a desert and shepherding someone else's flock. And at the end of 40 years, this guy doesn't even have his own flock. He's still shepherding his father-in-law's sheep. Not very successful 40 years. So he spends it, and this is what it was that he was involved in that entire period of time. And by the time he gets done with this 40-year period, this guy is wiped out.
Here he is raised as a prince, son of Pharaoh's daughter, grandson of Pharaoh himself. Stephen looks at him and again says, "And Moses was learned in all of the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in word and deed." This guy not only was smart, but he was a hard worker. He was not only one who was willing to learn, he was not only one who was good at both knowing, but he was one that was also good at doing. And when Stephen spoke that to the children of Israel in the book of Acts chapter 7, you didn't need to give them a lesson on Egypt, and you didn't need to give them a lesson on what Egypt was like at the time of Moses. They knew what Egypt was like. Egypt was at its pinnacle in terms of power, in terms of prosperity. They were a mighty, mighty empire in that day. The kingdom of Egypt was one of the greatest civilizations in the history of mankind. Their building projects, the discoveries that they made concerning science, in those days, in many ways, remain unequaled today in terms of our own abilities. They are not a backward people at all. Very, very technically astute group of people. Wealth beyond measure. The treasures of Egypt are just almost mythological in terms of what it was that they had. And tremendous power, able to enslave millions of people and keep them under their power. Here is this young boy, and he is taken and he is raised by Egyptian hands. God puts him right there in an Egyptian environment. He's trained up in the culture of Egypt, the culture of the pharaohs. And he is taken and he is separated completely from his people for that initial 40-year period. And everything is done to him to make him forget that he's a Hebrew. And they teach him, and they teach him, and they teach him in order that he'd forget about his Hebrew origin, that he would forget about the traditions of his race. He's completely educated in Egypt's wisdom, and he is bathed in Egyptian ritual. And all of Egypt lies at his feet when he hits 40 years of age. The whole thing is his. The whole thing is his for the asking. The whole thing is his for the taking. All that he needed to do was to give his life to Egypt and to forever and completely identify his life no longer with God or God's people, but now to identify his life completely with Egypt. And unless you and I are a student of Egyptian history, it is impossible for us to imagine what was at Moses' feet to receive. You think about that. I mean, what little we may know about Egypt at that time, all of that lay at his feet for just the asking. And oftentimes when we look at Moses, we look at these three 40-year periods of his life, our great tendency is to think that that first 40-year period was a waste, that God never brought any good out of it. Sure, we can understand what he did in the second 40-year period. We can understand, surely, what he did in the third 40-year period. But we look at that first 40-year period in Egypt, and we look at it and say, that must have been a total and complete waste. God must have gone in and completely removed everything out of his heart, out of his mind, every lesson that he learned there during that 40-year period. Nothing could have been good in terms of that first 40-year period. It was all a waste. That would be a very, very wrong assumption. Because in the midst of all of that wealth, in the midst of all of that materialism, in the midst of all of that opportunity, in the midst of all of that advantage that he had, really unparalleled, like nothing any of us have ever had or all of us put together into one person has ever had, as he watched all of the dealings in Pharaoh's house,
all of the comings and goings, all of the parties, all of the money, all of the wealth, all of the extravagance, all of the, you know, just the flashing of all of the wealth. As he saw all of this going on, and as he watched it in its cycle go on and on and on for 40 years, he learned a very valuable lesson. A lesson that if he hadn't learned, there would have never been a second 40 years and a third 40 years as he experienced them. And what he learned in that first 40 years was about the passing pleasure of sin. And as he watched all of the parties, and as he watched all of the drunkenness, and as he watched all of the debauchery, and as he watched all of the people given to even things that are considered good, that is the giving themselves to learning and to education and all of these types of things, as he watched all of these things go, he learned, and as they gave themselves completely to these things, how insatiable the flesh is even when it's given unlimited opportunity to satisfy itself. It can never be satisfied. And he learned that what extremes the flesh will go to find satisfaction and only find itself in greater bondage. And I think that the choosing of Moses, him choosing God and to suffer affliction with God's people, might in many ways be harder than we could ever imagine, but it might also have been easier than we can imagine. Having seen all of that for 40 years. And as he sees it, he chose God, he chose God's people, and he chose to suffer affliction with them. Sometimes the Christian that's raised in a poor circumstance, humbler beginnings, more difficult beginnings and environment when they're growing up, they can sometimes look at those who are raised in wealthier circumstances and think that of necessity that they... Must be devoid of true character and insight because they've been raised in great wealth or in great prosperity or in a great kind of a situation materially. But that's not necessarily true. It wasn't true of Moses. But I think it's very interesting what Moses put his eyes upon that impacted him to make the decision that he made. He made the decision to align himself with God, with God's people, and with what was right when he came out and saw an Egyptian abusing one of the Israelites. And all of a sudden he realized, became aware of the fact that the same system that had been so good to him victimizes others in order that it might be good to him. And that flashed in his mind. And don't think the system that we live under today isn't the same way. Sometimes I watch the guys on television try to figure out some of the things. They say, you know, you can't throw money at these problems, and you can't throw money at these people, and you can't throw money at this and that. And there's an awful lot of truth to that. But there's an awful lot of truth to the fact that we live in a system where money rules. And an awful lot of us get into positions that we are in terms of having money, good hard work, others just because you're raised into it and receive it. But when you're a part of the system and it's being good to you, it's very, very easy to forget that it's not so good to everybody. And that all of the things that I get and all of the things that I have may be at great expense to someone who have my opportunity. When I was over in India with Gail, one of the brothers that was with us desperately wanted to get an Indian rug and bring it home. We went into Bombay just before we left India, and he headed on into the center of Bombay to find where the carpets were being sold, and they were very cheap. compared to American prices. And Gale stopped him before he went down there. He ended up going down there anyway. But Gale said, let me tell you about what happens so that you can buy that carpet with American dollars so cheaply. He said, the average lifespan of the Indian man who works in those rug factories is about 32 years of age because of the amount of fiber that's thrown into the air. And they have no concern for their workers, only the money that is being made. There's not the type of standards and restrictions that we have in this country. And that worker will just make really 50 cents a day doing that. And it's not hard labor. It's not like he's working, you know, breaking up rocks on the side of the road to pave the roads or something like that. And that type of a worker makes about 50 cents a day U.S. And so he has a job that's a little bit easier, but he's going to end up typically dying in his early 30s as a result of the job that he has. In order that those carpets can be sent to the United States of America and we can go and buy them and see the little tag made in India and we buy them for dirt cheap, or someone between India and here marks it up like 1,500% before we ever see them. If you go into a store and you see something that's made in India and it's $30, somebody made a lot of money in the United States of America before it ever got here. The factory didn't make it, and the worker didn't make it. So the very systems, even the world, where the money rules, we need to realize what Moses flashed on and what he understood, and that was, this system's been good to me, but it doesn't mean it's a good system. It doesn't mean it's a right system. And it doesn't mean that I'm going to align myself and my identity with that system in terms of what I'm going to be identified with. This is an oppressive system. Now you look at it and you say, well, wait a second, you better be careful. You're talking about the capitalistic system. That's the best system in the world. It may be the best system in the world, but it still victimizes. It still victimizes. And the point is, in situation by situation that we find ourselves in, as children of God, Moses' heart pricked, conviction concerning it. There's a lot to look at, and there's a lot to consider. And so he realized that this system was oppressing his people, even though it had been very, very good to him. Brought great suffering upon God's people. And so as he saw this whole thing going on, and as he looks upon this scene and this abuse of this system towards the slave labor that's been put there to just support these opulent lifestyles of these royal figures and these people who have the money and all of the power. He looks at the scene and he suddenly realizes that for his life he needs to make a choice. And he's 40 years old and he needs to make a choice right at that point whether that's what he's going to be known for or if he's going to be known for something else. All of Egypt lays before him. And the choice sits there. Every one of us, every one of us as Christians, find ourselves in that place where the currency of this world, which is money, gold, the power that goes with it, whether we're going to take and involve ourselves completely in that system, or whether we're going to be careful as it relates to our involvement in that system and what we align ourselves with and what our life becomes known for. And so he chooses to suffer affliction with God's people. He's going to suffer affliction for doing what's right. This system is oppressive here, very oppressive system that's going on here in this chapter of Exodus. And so he chooses God. He chooses God's way and he chooses God's people. We all choose one way or another in the course of our life. All of us do. And when he chooses God's people and he chooses God, think about how he was looked at. Think about it. Just enter into his life for a moment. I mean, those are three dandy pyramids out there. And one sharp-looking sphinx. And all those fans made out of feathers. And all that sculpture and all that artwork and all that food and all that power and all that money and all of that stuff. And here he is raised 40 years and he says no to that to be identified with a bunch of slaves, a bunch of nobodies, a bunch of powerless people. And everybody, Egyptian and Israelite alike, has got to think this guy is crazy. He is out of his mind. Nobody throws away a degree in Egyptology to follow after that. Not after the money we've put into your education, not after the resources that we've put into this. You don't just walk away from that. You don't walk away from those things. You have no choice. And they thought he's crazy to do this. And everyone would look at him and the choice that he made and say, what a waste. What a pathetic waste. Don't do it, Moses. It's a waste. Identify with God's people at all costs. That's a waste. And they lament and they think, oh, this great mind that's lost. What, you know, what might have happened for Egypt through this great mind of his and this great education just thrown away and the power and the potential of this man. And everyone would laugh at him. Except for God. Except for God. Everyone would think it was a tragedy except for God. You'll find yourself in that place. I'm not saying to throw away an education. I think that we ought to go where God puts us, everywhere that He puts us, to be salt and light for Him. But there can be times when you make choices as a Christian, and everyone but God will think you are out of your mind. And that includes Christians. You're doing what? Come on. You're getting so heavenly minded, you're not going to be any earthly good. No. You've got to be heavenly minded to be any earthly good. And so it comes across the board, these kinds of things. We all face them. We all face them in the course of our pilgrimage. He faced it right there. We head into chapter 3 here. Here is Moses in his second 40-year period. Just got this flock, father-in-law's flock. What must he think of, man? I've got my own flock here, 40 years. Wandering around here out in the desert. Not even on the front side of the desert, I'm on the back side of the desert. I think it all looks the same, every desert I've seen. It's on the back side of this desert. And he is earning on the backside of that desert for that 40 years the most important degree that a minister will ever earn. And that's the BSD degree, the backside of the desert degree. And he goes through 40 years of preparation, the hands of God. 40 years that God prepares him on the backside of that desert, picking up that degree. And while he's picking up that degree for 40 years, in the life of Moses, every thought of greatness dissolves. Slowly, surely, gradually, completely, it dissolves. And he has great ideas of delivering God's people out of Egypt and great ideas in terms of what God's going to do with his life and all of these things and everything. But as he waits these 40 years and the nothingness of these 40 years, at least outwardly that appears, there's nothing left of the fire that was in his bones 40 years earlier. He doesn't have the slightest thought of now being the one who's going to deliver God's people from the oppressor. And here he is now, 80 years old. His youth is gone. His energy is gone. His education is shot. It's all outdated in 40 years. None of those units are transferable. And everyone would look at him and say, he is a failure. He made that stupid decision 40 years ago. He thought it would work out, and it's a disaster. He's every bit the failure and the foolish man that we thought he was 40 years ago. And all of his dreams and ambitions are gone. He's thinking the same thing at this point. All of it buried by 40 years of life in a desert until all he's thinking about at this point is just tending sheep. Let's see, how many do I have here today? Just thinking about eating today, drinking today, walking with God today in this desert, and then someday dying and going to be with God, this God that I've heard about. So here he is in this place. Everything he'd left Egypt for 40 years later, he still doesn't have it. But the whole time, God is working. Moses is in training. Moses is in training. God is developing his character, and he is giving him experience, and wisdom is being bestowed on this man. And the whole 40 years, Moses doesn't even have the slightest idea that he's being prepared, much less that he's learning anything during those 40 years. What could you learn tending sheep in a desert? Somebody else's sheep in a desert. And yet with 20/20 hindsight, we realize that God's preparation was absolutely perfect. It was just Moses couldn't see it yet. Because God had taken now and was developing 40 years worth of character that was necessary for this man, because unknown to Moses, he would spend the last 40 years of his life shepherding 3 million of God's sheep in a wilderness. And he couldn't see that yet. And we despise the little things. We despise the days of preparation. We overlook the ordinary and what God brings out of what we consider to be ordinary. And yet God was working. God was doing a great work. God was preparing him and preparing him perfectly.